Today on The Breakdown. Sometimes when you're playing in a 25K, you know, just randomly, you're up against people you know. Sometimes you're playing up against people you've never seen before, and once in a while you're up against someone whose game you know so well, so intimately, well, it almost works against you sometimes because you just know everything they think. You know, it's like there was a point when Tom Dwan issued his Dwan challenge to everyone in the world, like back in 2012, except for Phil Galfond. And it's because Phil knew his game so darn well. Also, he probably thought Phil was really good. Well, that's the kind of situation we're going to be up into right here. That is the way people talk, Grant. I see your face. It is a 25K, and Alex Foxen and Kristen Bicknell, two of the best players in the world, but also, they've had a partnership now for a while. Well, they are going to be playing a hand against each other, and they are not going to soft play. They are going to go for it against each other for sure. They're both going to make at least marginal plays at times against each other. It's pretty cool, and we're going to get into it right now on The Breakdown with Grant Dennison and Jonathan Levy.
Before any of you start speculating, this is not the hand that is the most famous hand between them, where it's not actually a good hand for poker commentary, but it's where there was some implied collusion because of the way they played the hands when they were three-handed, and it was a huge ICM spot in a 5K or something like 3 years ago, maybe 2 years ago, where like one of them should have absolutely gone broke and it didn't happen.
That's correct. We actually have done that hand in a breakdown. Back in the day,
we did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Huh.
Because we ended up having a whole long talk about collusion and stuff like that. And in fairness to them, like, first of all, everyone knows their relationship, right? Everyone who's playing knows that they've been their boyfriend and girlfriend and have been for a long time. And just to defend them a little bit, in that spot that you're referring to, they were three-handed. And before they started, they offered a deal to the guy who I think was, compared to them anyway, clearly not as good. But they offered a reasonable deal because they did know each other, and he's the one who turned it down, and then they're like, all right, and then they busted him and played each other. But anyone else in the world would have gone broke in either one of their spots.
Right.
Like, for sure. They would have been all.
Yeah. Them. And those are fair points because like it's not even close to the same thing. Like we don't share finances, and we are like, you and I are just professional like colleagues, and we travel together for poker. But if we ended up in a three-way situation at a poker table where like there was a ton of money up top and there was a third person we didn't know at all, I don't know. I think there might, it would be really hard to play like fully to try to maximize my edge against you at all times.
Right.
And I think vice versa would be the case.
I agree.
I can't imagine when it's like your actual significant other that you do share finances with like that. Obviously that's a problem in poker that is kind of unsolvable.
Yeah, it's a little bit unsolvable. You're right. Because I agree. I mean, you and I have been, you know, we were four-handed for a one hand anyway at a big final table once, you know, at a World Series of Poker Circuit event final table. We're at that final table, of course, the whole time together. And I would say our relationship did affect things a little bit, you know, like really only in one hand. And you shove preflop and I decided to fold a surprisingly good hand because I thought your range was... I didn't think I was doing great against your range. So, I mean, that's fair. But, like, anyone else in the world I would have gotten it in with, I think, probably, because, you know. Also, like, so I thought I was doing poorly against your range. I had ace-king, and I folded. You shoved 15 blinds. And I thought I was doing poorly against your range, meaning it was, like, usually a flip. I didn't think you were shoving 15 blinds with ace-queen. But also, I didn't really want to bust you, honestly.
I mean...
Like that was part of it.
To be fair, we swap in tournaments just like everybody else does who has friends who they think are good at poker and they are good at poker. Like that's just the world of poker and that's never going away. It's not actual collusion. We're not actually colluding, but the incentives line up strangely and it's just like exacerbated extremely for Foxen and Bicknell.
Exactly. So I mean, I certainly have busted you on final tables, and I think you busted me as well on final tables of reasonably big, not as big as the one I'm talking about, but reasonably big tournaments before. Like, I remember one time where I raised the button, you shoved the big blind, and I insta-called, and you're like, uh-oh, I'm gone. And another time where someone raised, you shoved, and then I re-shoved, and again, you said you were gone, although you ended up winning that hand. I think you made quads in that hand. You were ahead the whole way. It didn't matter. It was a flip. But... like, but it's, but like only when like the cards sort of demand that we get it in with each other, are we mostly going to get it in these spots, right? That's, that is kind of just the truth of it, right? And it is, yeah, it's a problem, but I don't know what to do about
it. As many poker players who are either professional or semi-professional, we have like a bit of a crew that I'm sure you guys have heard of us talk about, like the other guys we travel with. It's all the same among all of us. You know, we're always swapping small percentages and like not trying to hurt each other. But of course, we're playing these huge tournaments where usually you don't end up in a situation where you have to worry about it. Foxen and Bicknell, it's a bit sticky of a situation because like they're playing 25Ks. Those fields are small. They are going to end up in these situations more and more. But again, I think there are no solutions. I don't know what the solution could possibly be. You can only play. How do you like delineate which two players are allowed to play in a tournament due to their relationship? You can't really do that.
Like, I guess you could say, well, anyone who has any, you can't play in a tournament where you have any piece of anyone else in any way, right? You have, but then that gets weird. Like those 25Ks are too small. Like you're going to lose too many people. Like all these guys, all the pros are swapping with each other in different ways. Like that's just normal. And but it does create a messed up incentive structure. You are correct. And
yeah, and in those tournaments, the big deal tournaments like the one we're talking about, which is like the Party Poker Series or the World Series of Poker, there's not as much flexibility because they're more professional organizations. But we've played, you know, smaller tournament series where it's like $500 buy-ins, where if you get seated at the same table with somebody that you were traveling with or like have some incentive to not bust, you can tell them and say like, hey, can we get different seats? We're friends. You know, you can say stuff like that.
Yeah, you and I have done that.
At the very beginning of the tournament, you can redraw. But they don't do that in like the World Series of Poker and stuff.
No, they have no interest. But we've done that multiple times in tournaments, and sometimes they move us and sometimes they don't. Like there's multiple times you've sat on my left, and as the beginning, you know, day one, you know, level one, we're literally sitting next to each other. But also multiple times we've been at the same table and we told them and they moved us right away, moved one of us. So it's sort of up to the individual floor and whatever. I feel like as long as we disclose it, we're good. Like, I don't know what else we're supposed to do, you know, but
yeah.
And it's good to like, I mean, at least with Bicknell and Foxen, everyone knows, right? So,
yeah.
But it still doesn't change the fact that like, it's unlikely one of them is going to run a massive bluff against the other. Just like it's unlikely you or I would run a massive bluff against each other in a big spot in a big tournament where we swapped some significant percentage of each other, right? Just an unlikely, it's not impossible, I guess, but it's pretty unlikely. Maybe a small bluff, but like a big bluff, like really, you're going to check raise me and go check raise it with your gut shot, bet the turn and shove the river with like seven high, like really in a monster spot?
Seems unlikely. And you know, back to the original reason for this whole conversation, the hand in question, where I believe it was Jacks against Aces three-handed and Jacks flopped a set or something like that and somehow managed not to go broke on a relatively dry board.
Foxen flopped a set of Jacks and Kristen, I think, bet turn tiny and then check folded river somehow, because she just was like, Alex is never, ever betting a worse hand than this based on the board and based on the situation and because of our relationship. That was clearly part of it. I mean, I remember analyzing it with you and like that had to be part of it. She still had to figure it out, honestly, but
yeah. And
she also knows it's going to look bad, you know?
So that's the ultimate version of the situation where I guess the best solution is what they did was to try to offer the deal to the third person.
Yeah.
But if the person doesn't want to make a deal, then like, that really sucks once you're there because that person was supposed to get at least second place because of that hand, but they didn't.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Well, also, you know, like you're saying it that way, but like, what about the entire final table? Like, did they offer a deal as soon as they got to the final? Like, because also there may have been other hands leading up to that where perhaps they might have car crashed into each other because of a cooler type spot and they didn't. Or they might have made a play against each other if it was anyone else and they didn't. And then one of them is there longer, you know? And so someone busts seventh instead of sixth, let's say, and it cost them $50,000. Like, that's not really anyone's fault, but I don't know, man. It's not exactly okay either. You know, it's somewhere in between those two things.
Let's ask the audience if they have any like novel ideas about any sort of solves for these types of swapping situations that are just constant in especially live poker, especially traveling live poker. Like, is there anything that we're not thinking of solve wise that could make the incentives less perverse, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it gets really tough because number one, with all the hidden information in poker, even if you say, hey, Grant and I have swapped 20%, let's say, we announce that to the table, which I don't think we normally do. I think people assume that anyway because we're the poker guys, that it's some version of that. Yeah. They know we're good friends and stuff. It's obvious. But like, because no one can see our cards unless we're streaming it out, you know, like, you know, in the a cards up type situation, there still are, even if people know that we have done that, they can't know, like at that final table where I had ace king and I folded, like I went through, I sat there for like 6 minutes trying to decide what to do before I finally folded. But like someone who's watching, any other player could think I have ace jack suited or ace queen or pocket eights, you know, and like, and going through all this torture, they don't have to know it's as good as ace king. You know, but if they saw me fold ace king, they might be like, what? Wait a second. You know, they may think that's weird. It is weird. It's an unusual play. It turns out you had ace king too, by the way. And it was just a chop. It would have been a chop anyway. So I cost myself like a blind worth of value there. But yeah, like because of the hidden nature of the cards, number one, and number two, even if they could see the cards, they could be like, Levy, you can't, if they could see everything, like you can't fold ace king there. I'm like, well, here's why I folded it, because I know his game well enough to know he's never shoving ace queen for 15 blinds there. Like on this table in this spot. Like I know that. So like it's a flip or I'm chopping. That's it. But that doesn't mean, so I can say that, but does that make it okay? I don't even know if that makes it okay. And they have to believe it. And like even knowing the cards doesn't really solve the problem. Like there's no solve. Doesn't the edger have to be crypto? Can't we tokenize this in some way? Feels like the only possible.
Yeah.
Possible answer. I
the
don't
answer
know,
is crypto. Yeah, the answer is definitely crypto.
I mean, disclosing all the swaps is a start, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you could try to incentivize that by, like, some forward-thinking poker tour could say, like, hey, so in our tour rules, if you have a swap with somebody, it's the honor system, essentially, but if we find out that you didn't disclose it, then you are disqualified from ever playing this tour again, and each swap has a number, like no matter how many players there are in the swap, there could be like a four-player swap that's like swap 39, and like they have a patch that they wear that says swap 39, and like if two players at the table have swap 39 on their patch, you know those people have swapped, like that type of thing.
The problem is, how would they ever find out? It'd be so easy to hide that, you know, to hide that information.
It would, but like, but, it's just kind of like the threat of like, we will punish you if you don't disclose this, you know, which is not highly effective, but it would be more effective than no threat.
At the World Series of Poker, because we were doing the commentary for a few of those events this year, GG Poker has a cool thing where if you click on the player, because they do all the, they have staking like built into GG Poker, you can click on the player and see who's bought pieces of them. So you, that's all information is available in public. So that's like a little bit going in that direction anyway. It's not exactly the same, but it is moving. That's like a little better. You can say, oh, this guy owns a piece of him and they're at the same table. Like, and at least I know exactly how much of this person he owns. Like, at least I have that information.
It's all kind of about, through progress in poker, bringing all of the unwritten things to light, because we, for some reason, have decided that they're not okay and therefore they're taboo to talk about. Like, it's like a much lesser version of the World Series not allowing chops. Like, of course, chops should happen in poker. You should facilitate chops. It's what people want to do a lot of the time. It makes the game better. It makes it more transparent. It makes it what it should be. So let's just, like, we should allow swaps, but we should bring them to light, you know, because that's just, people aren't going to stop doing it, you know? It's like weed, right? Like, people are going to smoke weed no matter what, if it's legal or not, like, at least if the laws aren't the death penalty. You know, like
this makes me
get your tax money.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I played at a number of tables with Max Young, who's probably the second most successful Portland area tournament player in the world. Like, Ali, I don't want to mess up his last name, but
I think it's Msirovich.
Yeah, he's clearly the most, like, he's like one of the best players in the world. But Max has like won multiple circuit events and is a huge, huge, big deal. In his own way, like at least around here, and is one really, really impressive. Anyway, I've been at multiple tables with him, and like the amount of times he's asked me to swap, you've certainly swapped with him too. Like, he does it very publicly though. Like, we're all sitting at the table, like, I'll double up and I'll finally have about the same amount of chips as him, and I'll immediately say, you want to swap 10%? Just like in front of the whole table, which I always feels a little weird that, because he like didn't say it to any, he doesn't offer it to anyone else, only to me, but like he doesn't care. And there's something at least nice about it being so public, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's a little weird for two people, even at the table, to decide while we're still at the table together to swap a percentage. That's also weird now that I think about it, right? Like, now we have less incentive to go after each other. We've just created that. It didn't even exist before. Like, that's actually shouldn't be allowed now that I think about it.
You have to get the floor to get you a new tag that says swap 41.
I mean, but like you shouldn't like be able to sit down and say, hey, you seven players, we'll all swap and we won't swap with this guy, which is I mean, that's a more extreme version, but it is kind of like that, right? Like, so now me and Max are less likely to go after each other right away. Now we're probably less likely to go after each other anyway for other reasons, I mean, but still.
It's implied already that that's going to be the case for the most part.
You know, but more financial incentive, it matters. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, all right. Well, I think we've talked about that enough.
It's an interesting topic.
It really is. We could talk about it more.
Let's not. Let's talk about the hand, okay, which was suggested by one of the goats, Mark Testart from the Australia.
The Australian poet.
Yeah. Oh, he did attempt to make the poem that I challenged him to make. I don't have it in front of me, but I challenged him to make a poem because he had won a poetry award in 2007 or something using like these two terrible lines to start. And I think he did an okay job from my memory. If we can find it, we'll talk about it.
I'm going to take a shot at finding it. I don't know how easy it's going to be to find, but I'm going to take a quick...
All right, in the meantime, I'm going to tell you guys about the situation we're in, where it's day one of this 25K, and everybody's really deep. It's 5K, 10K. Alex Foxen is in the small blind in this hand, and Kristen Bicknell is in the big blind. And Foxen's got 1 million, so 100 big blinds. And he has, and there's no ICM considerations yet, it's early. He has ace deuce suited in the small blind, raises to 35K, 3.5xing, small to big. Seems totally normal to me. Bicknell has 1.3 million, so 130 blinds in the big blind, and two black sevens. And I want to ask you about this in after we find out if you found the poem.
Yeah, I have found the poem.
All right, let's hear the poem that Mark Testart wrote.
Hazy breeches feeding flowers, desperately unsmelled. Teenage deeds proceeding like a word that's left unspelled.
So he, the phrases he had to use were like a flower unsmelled, like a word unspelled.
Yeah.
But so he didn't exactly do the challenge because I challenged him to start the poem with those two exact lines.
It's true.
But I mean, fair enough. It's going to be impossible to write a good poem with those two lines being the first two lines.
I mean, tell that to Maya Angelou, motherfucker. But, not that she wrote poems, but, you know, still. I think teenage deeds proceeding like a word that's left unspelled. It sounds like it's important. It sounds profound.
It does.
It's not, I don't think, but it sounds that way, which is really all you have to do if you're a poet, right? Just come across as profound. So I'd say he did a great job, even though he didn't do exactly the task.
Yeah.
So it's also a failure, but a great, a great failure, a wonderful failure.
And just like suggesting this hand, by the way, which if I didn't mention it already, it's we are the Poker Guys on Twitter. If you want to suggest a hand, include a YouTube link and timestamp it, which, of course, Mark Testart does because he is one of the greats. All right.
He is.
So Foxen opens 3.5x, small to big, 100 blinds effective. Bicknell's in the big blind with two black sevens. She's the bigger stack. How do you generally proceed here?
I am mostly calling here. I have the advantage of position. I really like that. My hand is slightly under-repped if I just call. We're deep, which is one of the reasons why. If we had 20 blinds, I would be shoving, you know. I don't really want to bloat this pot. By the way, like three-betting and getting called, which is going to happen a fair amount. I'm going to have the best hand a lot, for sure, almost always. But now, like, sevens don't play super well post-flop, and Alex Foxen's tough. He's, like, super hard. He might be, you know, a top five player in the world. Like, yeah. I don't know. Why do I have to make a really big pot? Even if Bicknell's really good, too. She is. She's probably a top 10 player in the world. But, like, why make this so much harder? You can keep the pot small and have position with a hand that's slightly under-rep. That sounds great to me. And a hand that doesn't do well when it's four-bet. You know, so I don't know. I just want to call when we're this deep. What do you want to do?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I don't know what would happen if Bicknell had three bet, because she does end up calling. But Foxen does have kind of the perfect four betting bluff combo here. Ace, deuce of spades. Yeah. Any of the ace wheel suited hands are great for those situations. So she does end up calling. It's just the more comfortable of the options. And it just feels like a sigh of relief almost to not have to three bet this hand. Like, okay, let's just see a flop in position. Sounds good.
Yeah.
And that's what she does. So the pot is now 80,000 units of tournament currency. The flop is deuce of hearts, five of clubs, eight of diamonds. Pretty good flop for sevens. Foxen flops bottom pair with top kicker. Typically a bet for Foxen, you think? Just mostly protection?
Yeah, I think so. I think you just bet this, like, what good things are going to happen on the turn if we check? Like, even if it goes check, check, like, what good things? Not much. Feels like a clear bet.
That's what he does. He bets 27K. And here is the first truly interesting thing that happens. Kristen Bicknell raises to 80K with two sevens on the deuce 5-8 board. Let's talk this out. What is her intent? And is it good?
I'm not sure if her intent is to deny equity or just to get value from worse hands. I'm sort of leaning towards getting value from worse hands rather than just deny equity here. I don't know if we... I think she's expecting to get called by, like, a lot of his two big overcards, like, you know, the ace-jacks of the world, maybe even king-queens and king-jacks, his worst one pairs as well. I think this is a value play for the most part.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It has the added benefit of equity denial. If yeah. Foxen has a hand like Jack 9, he'll just fold, and that's totally fine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I guess that's what's going on, but it's certainly not the typical play that people make here. This is mostly right. A call.
Absolutely. No, I would probably just call without thinking about it, honestly. It really wouldn't occur to me to raise very often in this spot. I'd be happy to let Alex, you know, barrel off. And I'd also like to keep the pot small if I'm behind, you know, that's it.
Yeah. And if you're trying to be balanced, which I guess if you're going to be balanced against anybody trying to play well, if you're Kristen Bicknell, it has to be Alex Foxen.
Yeah.
As far as who knows your game the best. I don't know if we need to include this in the raising range because we have plenty of eights that we can raise if we want to raise one pair hands, which are significantly better raises because not only do we have a better hand, but we block Alex from having a hand that beats us, which sevens does not at all, except for 7-8. So it doesn't feel like we need to have balance, this hand in our raising range for balance if we're also raising our 3-4s and our 6-7s, maybe our ace wheels that have gut shots. I'm not sure.
I mean, that's why I'm really kind of believing this is a value play. I think she thinks like they're deep enough and Alex is sticky enough that if Alex has a pair of any kind, if he has a 5 or a deuce, he's not going to fold. If Alex has an ace high, he's on all, this is a very straighty type board, straight drawy type board, right? She's got a million gutters here and some open enders and stuff in theory. Alex is probably calling with his ace highs, his reasonable ace highs, at least, you know, maybe not ace six, but ace three, yeah. Ace four, and probably ace nine plus are all calls, I would guess.
So
maybe she just thinks she can get reasonable value out of it and control the hand a little bit too. And maybe, like we're saying, equity deny a little bit too. She does block some of the straight draws, which, you know, I don't know if we really want to do that if we're raising for value, but if he's going to call with all his deuces, which I think he is, if he's going to call with most of his ace highs, which I think he is, maybe it's okay.
So you think this is a mandatory call for Foxen because Bicknell could not only have the open enders, of which there are 2, 3, 4, and 6, 7. I'm not sure if she has unsuited 3, 4. She may or may not. I assume she has unsuited 6, 7.
Yeah, I'm sure she does.
So it's at least 20 combos of those. And then if you add in a bunch of gut shots, which I think is reasonable to do probably, then I guess you do have to call with the ace deuce, even though it's not comfortable.
I mean, and let's not forget, it's okay if we're behind some of the time, right? Because we have equity.
Yeah.
Like we can hit it. We almost always are. Our ace is usually good if we hit it. Our deuce is really almost always good if we hit it. There is no backdoor flush draw, which is a little bit worse. I think Foxen, though, is just like against these players, like he's learned basically if he has something on the flop when he's c-betting at all and gets raised, he just always calls. Like he just doesn't fold any pair. I've watched him do it. You've seen him too, like against, is it Vogelsang who did this against? Olashemian maybe? I don't remember. One of those guys.
Igor Kurganov?
That's who it was. Yeah. Yeah. Where he had third pair. And Kurganov like 3-bet him or something crazy like that with a flush draw.
He 3-bet the flop, yeah.
And Foxen held on and ended up winning the hand. It was pretty interesting. And I remember Dan Coleman doing similar things where getting raised on the flop with just any pair, it's like an easy, obvious call to these guys because they're so used to being attacked. I think on boards like this too, where it's like in theory better for a Kristen, right? It's got to be better for Kristen's range.
Yeah, which I assume is Foxen's strategy only when he's playing against elite fields. I don't think that's a good strategy against weak fields, like just calling every time you get raised, even if you have bottom pair and it's like the tightest person in the world. I don't think that's a good idea.
I'm sure Foxen isn't doing that without knowing anything. Yeah. I don't see how he could be successful and even navigate these fields if that was true, right? Like it just can't be.
Right. Yeah, but maybe his overall strategy against the really good players is just like, I'm going to hold on more than the other people do, and that's going to be profitable because they're always taking shots.
Yeah. I know when Mike McDonald went on his big run, and this was a long time ago, this was like 2013 or something, when he won like $1 million in 3 different tournaments in a year.
When he was 18 and had braces on the whole time.
No.
He was not 18. Thinking of You're thinking of a different time. I'm thinking of Mike McDonald's first EPT win when he was 18.
Right. No, I'm talking about when he hit three different $1 million scores in 1 year. And that was that was when he like ascended to not just an EPT winner who was a little famous, to being like, oh, this guy's like legit. And they asked him, well, what is he doing differently? And he said, I'm just calling more than I used to. And I think especially against those EPT fields where everyone was like always taking shots at everyone, insanely crazy, just holding on, you know, 10% more of the time or 15% more of the time, probably really profitable. You know, you just bump down your holding on range another 10 or 15%. You probably just zoom up in terms of EV.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, but so Fox course. And holding on makes sense.
Of course, against the best players in the world, they're going to be balanced enough that that can't be effective forever.
Yeah.
But for now, I guess that's the strategy for Foxen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Foxen's trying to be balanced too, though, right? So he knows knows how many C-bets he has on this board. And that means ace-deuce is just part of the stuff he doesn't fold when he gets raised. He's got to fold like at least 30% of his C-bets here. And ace-deuce is just too good in his mind.
That's correct. He does call. The pot's going to be 240K. And Nitrogen Sports Poker is where you should play poker. You know what I'm saying, Jonathan?
That's right. They have pizza. They have heroes. They have euros. They have years.
That may be true at their corporate offices. Yeah. They might have those services. I can't verify that. Mm-hmm. What I do know is that they have the greatest iterated value in poker, the monthly Poker Guys tournament, which you can only gain access to by clicking the link in the description of this podcast when you sign up for Nitrogen. It is a 1,000 buy-in guarantee. We never get more than 300 players because they don't allow more than 300 players. We actually get more like 200. That means you're getting 5-1 on your money, and you're a complete moron if you do not use the link and play the tournament.
That's some tough love, but it was needed.
I think that the audience needs tough love sometimes.
Yeah. Like you're never going to make it unless you really pick up your bootstraps and strap them on your boots
and click the link. That's all is required of you, is to click the link and sign up. That way you get access to the tournament. It is truly a great value, an obscene value. They also of course have sports betting, casino games. NFL is starting up, at least for now. We're hoping that continues. Oh, yeah. You can bet on that.
Let's go.
Of course, if you bink something sports betting wise, that tournament, any other poker thing, and you want your Bitcoin fast, Nitrogen is a Bitcoin only site, and they don't mess around with your money. If you withdraw, you get it in 90 minutes, which is not the case for other sites for unknown reasons. Unknown, frustrating reason.
Sometimes 4 or 5 days later, it's so annoying. Yeah.
It is quite annoying. Nitrogen, not annoying. An excellent element and also an excellent website. And you should go there using the link.
Wow. You took that one all the way home, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah, you bought the corsage, you put it on the dress, you went out dancing after the prom, and then you took it home.
Okay.
I feel like you just turned all red. Your face, you're just blushing. What's happening? You got embarrassed?
I didn't turn red. What are you talking about?
Your face got really red. I'm looking at it. You're super red.
I'm looking at it too. I can see it. There's a little thing in the, you know, video chat. It doesn't look red to me.
It's tiny in your video chat. I'm seeing a much bigger version of it. Trust me. You are embarrassed. Just trust me.
Yeah, I'm embarrassed because you talked about prom. That really got me.
Do you spend a lot of time in prom? You go to a lot of proms, Grant?
I went to 2 proms.
Yeah.
How about you?
Yeah, same. 2 proms.
Cool.
Yeah. They were kind of a waste of time. Let's move on. Let's go back to the hand.
It's the only time I've worn a tuxedo. Tuxedos are stupid.
I've worn a tuxedo many times.
But I've never gone to like a black tie wedding or anything. Weddings are not as formal as they used to be.
I've never worn a tuxedo at a wedding. I've worn a tuxedo at other events, yeah. But multiple other events. I mean, once you own a tuxedo, you look for reasons to wear it, honestly. It's like once every 18 months, you're like, this is a time I can wear that tux. And then I do. I wore it doesn't matter.
Let's to the Met Gala? Did you go to the Met Gala? Is that where you went?
I did not, but our friend Kelsey
You weren't invited, obviously.
I was not actually invited. I admit that. That's okay. Were you? Did you go? What did
I
you wear?
I didn't go. I didn't go, and that's all I'll say about that. I'm not going to clarify whether or not I was invited.
It makes it sound like you chose not to go.
It does.
Yeah.
I'll leave that up to you to interpret.
All right. I want to figure out my
Why would I go to the Met Gala? What's the point, man?
The snacks. The snacks have got to be outrageous.
Why would I want to eat caviar and snails and shit? Rich people eat the grossest parts of animals.
They eat cheese.
I do like cheese.
I know.
But if you think about what cheese actually is, it's pretty gross.
Well, if you think about what most things actually are, it's pretty gross.
But cheese especially.
Really? How about hamburger?
Yeah, that's gross. Yeah,
how about mushrooms? Right. I mean, come on. Like, I can do this all day, buddy.
Nothing wrong with fungus, man.
Yeah. Come on, mold?
I mean, I don't eat mold. I do eat delicious mushrooms.
Okay, cheese boy. You don't eat mold. That makes a lot of sense, what you just said.
I actually do. I do eat blue cheese. It's delicious.
Yeah, see? You're a wreck.
All right.
Your lies shine through. Mark Testart, use that in your next poem. All right, back to the hand.
You're a wreck, your lies shine through, or just your lies shine through?
Your lies shine through. The wreck part is very pedestrian, I think.
Quite. All right, so there's two...
Our warrior, lawyer, poet, you know, I expect more from him. Sorry, please get...
Okay, so there's 240K in the pot. Bicknell has two black sevens on a deuce of hearts, five of clubs, eight of diamonds board. Foxen has ace, deuce of spades. He bet the flop, got raised by Bicknell. Foxen called, 240K, four of spades, hits the turn. It is a relatively coordinated card. I mean, a couple straights get there. Some straight draws make a pair. It's not a hugely coordinated card, but it's among the more coordinated ones, I guess. And Foxen checks, that seems normal. Mm-hmm. Should Bicknell bet again?
I don't know. I think you can make a pretty good case that maybe raising on the flop is a way for her to get to cheaper showdown than by calling the flop. Because usually what happens with good players is they bet tiny on the flop, and then on the turn, they start to really size it up, right?
Yeah.
And so she takes 35K and bets and turns into 80K. There's no way if Foxham's going to triple barrel, there's no way he's betting 55K on the turn. Like,
it was 27K actually into 80K.
Oh, okay. My mistake. You're right. He raised to 35K pre. So she made it a little more. But still, there's no way he's betting 63K on the turn either, I don't think. I think the pot's just going to be, you know, 63 into like 150.
There's no way he's betting on the turn, actually, if she just called. He's not betting this turn card if she just called the flop.
Well, that's because we know his hand. But we're talking about from her point of view. If she doesn't want to get triple barrel, then like play a huge pot. This may actually keep the pot smaller, where she only has to call potentially one big barrel on the river instead of two big barrels on turn and river, and also deny equity and also take control of the pot sometimes. She might decide to bet for value on the river, depending on what happens. I guess those are all good reasons to check. I guess we should check. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but is it face up to check? Is it like admitting that you had a mediocre hand on the flop?
I mean, as long as we call the river, does it matter that much?
I guess that's true.
I mean, I think, betting is over-repping our hand on the turn, I think. Checking is not really under-repping our hand, but is either, looks face up. We look weak, but we probably have a lot weaker hands than this, too, that we might play this way. So, I don't know. I mean, ace-3 gets there. That is a reasonable holding for Alex, but there's a lot of other hands that ace-4 got there, but we're winning. We're beating it. We're still beating any deuce. We're still beating any 5. We're beating pocket 6s. We're beating ace-highs in general, like ace-9, ace-10, etc. It's close. I think I would check if I was in this situation, but I don't know if she's supposed to, but I feel like I get why she does.
Yeah, me too. It's kind of like preflop with not three-betting preflop. It just feels more comfortable.
Yeah. If we know we're going to call a lot of rivers, then it's okay. You know, if we're just going to fold a lot of rivers, then I don't like this play as much. Because then we're folding a hand for value. Then I'd like to bet small right now and check back the river.
But maybe we fold on an ace or something like that.
I think folding on an ace and he decides to bet is probably a good idea. Because like the four also makes some weird straights and he'd have to turn like a weird four into a bluff like otherwise. So
he's definitely capable of that.
I know. Or a five, maybe turn a four. He wouldn't really have a weird four, but maybe a five. Maybe he has 3-4 or any 5 or any deuce. He could turn that into a bluff if an ace comes. But maybe he wouldn't think he needs to, you know? Like if he calls with ace-deuce on the flop, sometimes he has to be good to be able to call there, right? So,
well, 3-4 would be a straight, by the way, if an ace
came.
Right.
Well, then we should definitely fold if he's got a straight.
Yes. That's not what happens. It does go check-check. The river is the deuce of diamonds.
I mean, there is no joy in Mudville. Is what I will say.
What does that mean? What is that referencing?
Really? Casey at the Bat. It's one of the all-time most famous sports poems.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of it, and I think maybe you've recited pieces of it to me while I drifted off to sleep from boredom.
The gist of it is this. Like, Mighty Casey shows up. He's the greatest baseball player. Everyone talks about him. He comes up in a big spot at the end of the game. They're down, like, by a run, but there's two guys on base, something like that. There's two outs. And, you know, the pitcher's pitching, and it's a whole poem about this whole thing. And at the end, they don't tell you what happened. They don't, like, give you the play-by-play of it. Instead, it's just, like, he's up the bat, and the pitcher's about to pitch, and then we, like, cut to the last verse, which is, you know, somewhere there are children playing, and somewhere something shouts, but there is no joy in Mudville, for Mighty Casey has struck out. And it's, like, turns out this great, iconic player failed. The end.
I mean,
and it was a big deal in the 20s or something.
Why is it such a big deal for him to strike out? Isn't it like a really good batting percentage, like 350? Like, yeah, that would be incredible.
I think it's
so 65% of the time you're going to strike, like, not strike out necessarily, but you're not going to get on base. So, like, maybe not make a huge deal out of this one time. Like, how fragile were people at this time?
I really, like, think it's for people who don't
how
really
little do they understand of probability.
I think they just don't know much about baseball in the 20s, you know? So, like, that seems really bad to strike out. Maybe, I think curveballs were not used much. People didn't really strike out in the 20s as much. I know when they introduced the curveball, whatever it was, the 1890s or whenever, the president of Harvard University said he would never allow a Harvard man to throw a curveball because it's lies and deception, and a Harvard man would never engage in a competition in that way. Like, he was cheating. That's like a real thing.
That's to me, that is just obscene. That's, yeah, like the stupidest thing.
Well, you know, I'm sure they changed their mind at some point, but you know, people were dumb back then.
Well, I mean, that code of honor shit still exists. Like, you see it in poker all the time. I mean, we haven't played live poker for a while, but in live poker, you have people who will, like, show their hands a couple times and be really mad when you don't show them your hand when you don't have to, because it's, like, some sort of code of honor thing. Some people will even get mad that you bluff them. You know, they'll be like, that's, like, rude to bluff them. Like, you're not supposed to do that.
I still remember, this is a little different, but I still remember playing the main event of the World Series, day two, 2 years ago or whatever it was. And somebody raised, I think I called, and then somebody went all in for a little bit more, and we both called. We saw the flop. No, he went all in for a lot. He went all in for like three blinds, and somehow there was a big side pot. I don't remember exactly, but somehow maybe there must've been a three bet, and this dude went all in. But, like, so it was between the two of us. I think I must've three bet like ace queen or something like that. So there's like 20 blinds in the side pot, or 15 blinds in the side pot, and like six blinds in the main pot. Whatever. The guy checks. I miss, but I bet anyway to win the fucking big side pot. The guy folds. The short stack has pocket fives. They hold. He wins, right? The guy who I bluffed out is really upset about it and cannot stop saying, I've never seen a dumber play in my life in poker. He just keeps saying it. And I'm like holding back saying, like, did you see the size of the side pot that I got to win? Because he would have won the hand and he would have knocked the guy out. We're on day two, by the way, of the World Series. Like, we're a day and a half away from the money. Like, knocking a guy. But, like, he's so used to thinking, like, you're just supposed to check it down if someone's all in. He can't see past that. And, like, he thought there was the same kind of thing of, like, a code of honor or something. He kept saying how stupid I was. It was really weird. I then picked off a huge bluff of his later, and it was awesome.
I'm not entirely sure that is a code of honor particularly. I think that might be a particular type of stupidity that you see in a lot of poker players where they learn something through groupthink and then think it applies to every situation that's similar. Sure. So he's learned from players better than him that it's a really bad idea to bluff into a dry side pot. But he doesn't know what a dry side pot is because that certainly was not a dry side pot. That was a soaking wet side pot. And it was worth taking, even if you didn't have anything.
It was.
I've seen it many times that people don't understand that, like, the fact that there's an all-in player and there's still action doesn't mean you shouldn't bet. If you have a really good hand and you want action, you should bet, even if it's a dry side pot. If you have nothing or something, or just want to equity deny and there's valuable chips in the side pot, you can bet. That's fine. That's allowed. It's not a dumb play. It's not stupid in any way.
Yeah, that's correct. He thought it was dumb, but I got more chips than he did. I got to win that pot. It was great.
The best code of honor thing in poker that's like the best by best I mean stupidest that I've experienced was the first time I ever played live poker. I played 3-6 limit hold'em. It was really boring, but I check raised this woman who was clearly a regular at this casino in Washington, and she looked at me and was like, oh, You're going to check raise me, huh? It's going to be like that. You're going to check raise me? You can check raise in your game at home, son, but I don't think you should be check raising here. This is real poker. I was just like, is this a real thing? Like, it was my first time playing. I was like, is this a real thing? Like, people don't check raise? Because it's rude? Because it's like, it's lying. It's lying when you check and then you raise.
It's really amazing. The people are really amazing, is what I'll say. All right, you know, let's get back to it.
All right. I think there was actually not allowed in some games back in the day to check raise. Like, there was like poker signs that say, like, no check and then raise.
Yeah, no, or no, usually what the signs say is check and raise is allowed in this establishment. Like,
yeah,
implying that it isn't. They have to freaking write it down and put it on the wall. When I was at Bay 101, I think it's on the wall, and like among their rules, like, that you're allowed to check raise, like, because apparently there's a question if you're allowed to do that sometimes.
Because it's a lie. You're lying when you check raise.
Yeah, it's the curveball. It's the Harvard curveball. We're back to that, you know?
Yeah. All right, back to the hand.
Okay.
Let's finally circle back here. Deuce of hearts, five of clubs, eight of diamonds flop, which was raised by Bicknell with 2 sevens. The turn is the four of spades. Alex Foxen called the raise with ace, deuce of spades. So it's now deuce five, 8-4. The river, deuce of diamonds, which is unfair because Alex Foxen now makes trips.
Yeah.
Makes all the sense in the world for Foxen to bet, right? Went check, check on the turn. Got to try to ensure some chips go in.
I think he has to bet. I mean, when she checks the turn, I'm putting her on a four a lot of the time. Actually, yeah. Like 3-4 kind of a thing, or 4-6 or something.
Ace-4 maybe.
One of those mostly. Like, he almost always has the best hand, and it seems crazy not to try and get value. And she usually has one pair.
Well, he goes for value in a big way. He bets 255 into 240.
Yeah.
So I assume if he was bluffing, he would usually choose similar sizing.
At least with some of his bluffs, yeah.
It makes sense from a balance perspective because, like we were saying on the turn, when Kristen checks back, it looks like she has kind of a mediocre-ish showdownable hand. And mm-hmm. I was concerned about how face-up that was, and you said it doesn't matter if we're calling the river. Well, if you're going to be balanced here and also have bluffs, you're going to have to bet really big to ensure that sometimes those hands do fold the river, even mm-hmm. on relatively innocuous runouts.
Yeah. I mean, you definitely need to bet this big with some of your range, for sure. And I think you can also have smaller sizing with another chunk of your range, right? But yeah I agree with you completely. Like, we're going to want to bluff with this sizing at times. And so we have to, this is like a perfect spot to, on a deuce, which looks like how do we, we don't have that many deuces in theory, right? We raise pre, we call, I mean, we just don't have that many. So it seems like
we're probably not raising too many deuces pre-flop, blind versus blind.
Right.
When we're super deep, like, there's no point.
I feel like the value we're repping is either like over pairs or ace three, which is the wheel. Like, I feel like that's more like what we're repping, even though we've got, you know, trip deuces
here. What do you think about, what about like a good eight, like queen eight plus? Do you think that could possibly be in the value?
I wouldn't expect it to be, only because we block an eight, which was a hand we'd really want her to have. So I don't know if we choose this sizing, because now we assume she has less than an eight even, which is then harder to get called. So,
well, I mean, there's still plenty of combos of eights available to her, even if we have one.
There are.
Which is why I specified a big eight. You know, maybe queen eight shouldn't be in it. Maybe just king and ace eight.
She's probably betting like her eights on the turn at least some of the time, right? I know she didn't bet her sevens, but like that's like a big difference.
Well, it's a big difference to her because she doesn't block an eight, and Foxen could easily have an eight.
Yeah. So I don't think he would choose this sizing, but I could be wrong. I'm very open to being wrong about this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure either. So let's keep that in the back of our minds when analyzing what Bicknell should do, because we've ranged him at having basically ace deuce only for deuces. Maybe he has king deuce suited, but you'd expect preflop he's not really going to 3.5x small to big with those hands that often when they're this deep and there's not that much incentive to like take down the pot preflop.
I mean, king deuce suited is still at least a favorite against her, you know, her, all of her hands, the unlimited range that we're starting with there. So maybe he's raising king deuce suited, but I agree with you. He doesn't have very many deuces. Clearly he can't have very many deuces.
And okay. So then moving on from deuces, obviously he does have ace deuce suited. I'm And probably king deuce suited. Probably ace deuce off also, I would guess.
Yeah, sure.
And then how likely is he to have sets? Like, does he play a set of fives like this very often? Does he play a set of eights like this very often?
I would guess he's probably more apt to play a set of eights like this than a set of fives like this. Because if he has fives, she has more eights, and then that's a hand we could decide to attack. Although, honestly, if we three bet the flop, I don't know if she's going to call with an eight anyway. Like, that may just be too much. So maybe we have, I think we can have some sets here, is I guess where I'm going. Maybe all the sets we can have. Obviously, we're going to not all play them all this way. We're going to three bet some of them. We're probably going to lead the turn with some of them. But a fair amount of the time, I think we're going to call the flop. When it goes check-jack, we're going to bet really big on the river. So,
and then do you think we include in our value range nines plus all of the overpairs?
At least some of the time. With this sizing, at least some of the time. Like more than half the time, how about?
So that's a fair amount of value combos that we're coming up with that Bicknell has to worry about. So what are the reasonable bluffing combos? I guess it's anything with a four in it that was also a straight draw on the flop.
Yep. Like 4-6 is a pretty good one. That's a double gutter.
It would be a good one if it weren't for preflop. Like, is Foxen going to 3.5x when it's not that important with hands like 3-4 and 4-6? Yeah, it might just be ace-4.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, so there's only a few fours here. Could he have 5-4? And if so, no, but then he just has a 5. It's really effectively a 5, right? Because the deuce is paired. So
yeah.
It plays as a 5, mostly, unless she has a 5 also, but I don't think we'd count on that. We're not trying to get value or bluff. It's a weird spot to bluff. Is he turning a 5 into a bluff? Maybe is a better question, because he has a bunch of 5s, right, comparatively.
Yeah.
I mean, a bunch. He has like 5-6 suited, 5-7 suited, ace-5, maybe king-5 suited. Maybe he has other suited 5s as well that he's choosing to play aggressively pre.
Maybe. I don't know. It's tough. It's tough to come up with the bluffs.
I mean, there is a big blind ante here, right? So he makes it 35K. She calls. There's 80K in the pot. So there's extra to win. So maybe he's just very aggressive in this spot with a lot of hands. Anything playable.
We didn't mention that 6-7 got there on the turn, which is kind of important.
Yeah, we sure did not mention that. That feels like a really big deal for us to mention.
Yeah.
Now, when she checks it back, we're not worried about her having it. We can definitely have it. Right now, she knows that we're unlikely to have it because she has 2-7s. But as Alex, we can't be thinking about that, right?
Okay, so it's good that we block that as Bicknell. Yeah. That's one point in favor of like we can call.
Yeah,
but I don't know if the value is this expansive. If we think he like, I guess it depends on if it is this expansive. Is it inclusive of overpairs, or is he too worried about the coordination of the board?
I mean, when the deuce pairs after she checks the turn, I think he can bet and not worry about it. He's going to fold to a raise, right? Well, not with this hand maybe, but with like two nines. He's going to bet fold when we bet, if he bets 255. I mean, I think there's a fair, I think he can have over pairs. I really do. I think the question for her is what bluffs does he have besides like one pair bluffs? Does he have all these overcard bluffs? Does he have like ace queen, ace king, ace nine, ace ten? Is he just checking those? Does he have king queen that call? Does king queen call a raise? Does jack 10 call a raise pre? I don't know. You know, I'm not clear. Does 9-10 suited that's a backdoor flush also call a raise on the flop? Or does he just throw it away because, like, whatever, it's out of position and it's not great? If he has all those hands, then we have a pretty clear call. If he has very few of those hands, I think we don't have enough. There's not enough there, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right.
So she should know the answer to this, though. She should know what he's calling the raise with. And then it should be a relatively straightforward answer.
It seems like she thinks the answer is that he has enough bluffs because she calls.
Yeah, she's got to think that means he has like ace queen and bluffs here, you know, king queen and bluffs here for sure. That's what this call is saying, right?
Yeah. Seems like it.
That's pretty interesting. I would think he wouldn't even expect to be able to fold out like an eight on the river with this sizing anyway, would be my guess, right?
Probably.
So he's only like taking shots at like these, as you're saying, the face up medium strength hands on the turn. And that's it if he's bluffing.
It's an interesting one. It's because it's also hard to analyze where Bicknell falls in her distribution when she takes this weird line.
For sure. Maybe she checks back an eight some of the time.
Yeah.
Does she ever check back like a monster on the turn? Like she makes, I think if she turns a straight, she's betting, right? If she has a monster, she's just going to bet because they call the race, right?
You'd think so. You'd really think so.
So, yeah, if she has like four deuce or five deuce, she flopped two pair. She's just going to bet. Well, no, she's going to bet the turn, I think, if with five deuce even. I mean, that's beating us as Alex, but from her point of view, she's just betting all her good stuff on the turn. This is often a problem. I've been noticing this. I've been thinking about this for like a solid 2 years now, on and off, because I played a hand in the monster stack where this guy, I assumed he was bluffing. I don't even know. But I took a line where I bet the flop, I checked the turn, I bet the river. And he check raised me all in on the river. And I remember thinking like, yeah, that's a pretty weak line. Like I just so rarely, and the board obviously played out in such a way that the river wasn't a scare card for him. And it wasn't, I was just like trying to take a shot. Cause like, you know, he didn't show any, he didn't seem like he wanted it. And like, what am I going to do? I didn't have enough. I had like jack high or something. But when he check raised all in, I felt completely owned. I felt like this guy knows that it doesn't matter whether he has, he just knows I don't have it. Cause like my line is too weak and that card didn't help me. And like, he just knows that like, I sort of can't have it here. Maybe he probably had a blocker of some sort, but you know, and it's just like checking the turn is often, it's like hard to have a really strong hand unless the river card really changes things, you know?
Yeah.
If you show aggression on the flop and don't bet the turn. And so, I don't know, it's one of the lines I've been thinking about attacking more and more when I play is like the bet line, unless the board changes dramatically.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think Bicknell's call is not, it's not something to chastise. It's also not something to celebrate. It's just kind of like a, I guess I get it, but I'm not sure.
It's almost like, well, she knows more about his range than we do. And so since she thinks that this is a call with sevens, it's probably a call with sevens against his range then, right? But like, it's probably pretty close. It's not great. She takes a little while to think about it. She clearly doesn't like it. She knows it's probably barely profitable to call is my guess and does, right? Something like that.
Yeah.
She's like hoping he's turning a five into a bluff mostly, or it turns over ace nine.
I guess you can hope.
I guess. I mean, against any normal player, obviously, we wouldn't have taken this line anyway with two sevens. We just would have called the flop. But, like, we would definitely fold the river. I guess any, like, regular dude who bets more than the pot in this spot. Music is my sunlight, and all I need is one mic. And I can show every single MC how it's done right. Every time I come by, I'm bound to leave them tongue-tied. I'm sipping on liquor, a quitter is what I'm not. We got one life, and I took a minor break. But I'm back to claim the throne. I'm gonna be traveling the globe. We still have time to make it home.